It's Friday, February 13, 2015. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. One of the most important political memoirs of recent history came out this week. That's David Axelrod's book, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. Axelrod was a major political advisor to now President Barack Obama. And it was so even when Barack Obama was deciding on whether or not to run for the United States Senate. David Axelrod was very important for the so-called political messaging of Obama's campaigns, not only for the United States Senate, but of course in two runs for the United States presidency, elections that Barack Obama won. These days, in terms of the American political scene, we often need to understand there can be a difference between the message and the messenger, and sometimes the messenger changes the message. That has been a particular issue with President Barack Obama and the issue of same-sex marriage. And that's because if you go back to 1996, when he was a candidate for the state Senate in Illinois, he indicated his support for the legalization of same-sex marriage. Later, when he was running for president in 2008, he was not for same-sex marriage. He said, referring to what he called sacred marriage, that it should be restricted to a man and a woman. And then, when he ran for president in 2012 for re-election, he came right out and said that his position, which he previously said had been evolving, had evolved to his full support for the legalization of same-sex marriage. In recent months, he's gone to the point of suggesting that the Supreme Court should rule that same-sex marriage should be legal nationwide, coast to coast, in all 50 states. This kind of political evolution is not unprecedented, but it's particularly notable on the issue of same-sex marriage when it comes to President Obama. And no one has made this more clear than David Axelrod. After all, he was in charge of President Obama's messaging in this memoir. Again, the title is Believer. Here's what he writes, and I'm reading directly from pages 446 and 447 of the book. Quote, gay marriage was a particularly nagging issue. For as long as we had been working together, Obama had felt a tug toward his personal views and the politics of gay marriage. As a candidate for the state Senate in 1996 from liberal Hyde Park, he signed a questionnaire promising his support for legalization. I had no doubt that this was his heartfelt belief. Quote, I just don't feel my marriage is somehow threatened by the gay couple next door, end quote, he told me. Yet he also knew his view was way out in front of the public's. Axelrod continues, opposition to gay marriage was particularly strong in the black church, and as he ran for higher office, he grudgingly accepted the counsel of more pragmatic folks like me, and modified his position to support civil unions rather than marriage, which he would term a sacred union. Having prided himself, says Axelrod, on forthrightness, though, Obama never felt comfortable with his compromise and no doubt compromised position. He routinely stumbled over the question when it came up in debates or interviews. I have to skip the language in the next line. And then Axelrod writes, by 2010, he had told reporters that his position was evolving. And in 2011, the administration announced that it would no longer fight in court to uphold the Defense of Marriage Act, a controversial Clinton-era law absolving federal and state governments of their obligation to recognize gay marriages sanctioned in states where they were legal. Yet, according to Axelrod, if Obama's views were evolving publicly, they were fully evolved behind closed doors. The president was chomping at the bit to announce his support for the right of gay and lesbian couples to wed, and having watched him struggle with this issue for years, I was ready too. He cites President Obama as saying to his campaign manager, Jim Messina, quote, I just want you guys to know that if a smart reporter asked me how I would vote on this if I were still in the state legislature, I'm going to tell the truth. I would vote yes, end quote. Now, that predates when the president actually did announce his support for same-sex marriage. And Axelrod makes clear that timing was due in part to the fact that Vice President Joe Biden had rather jump-started the discussion when he appeared on Meet the Press early in the 2012 campaign and announced in his words, quote, I am absolutely comfortable with the fact that men marrying men, women marrying women, and heterosexual men and women marrying one another are entitled to the same rights, all the civil liberties, and quite frankly, I don't see much of a distinction beyond that, end quote. Now, one of the sad facts of politics in a sinful world is that lies happen, which is to say, politicians tell lies, and the handlers of politicians tell other lies. And if it's not outright a lie, sometimes it's a significant discount off of the truth. But that's not to absolve any politician on any issue. It's not to absolve anyone from the responsibility that is made clear in Scripture of telling the truth. But my main point in bringing this issue to light is to point to President Obama's self-described evolution on this issue as a signal of just where we are and even recently have been in this culture. What we're looking at here is the fact that President Obama made his announcement after, considerably after, he felt it was politically safe to do so. And what Axelrod makes very clear is that when he stated in public that he was opposed to same-sex marriage, even when he said that in 2008, it wasn't what he personally believed. Now, there are a couple of really important issues we need to look at here. One of them is the fact that President Obama, in response to the controversy that came out after David Axelrod's book was published earlier this week, came out and said that Axelrod's account wasn't exactly right. In an interview given to the website BuzzFeed, he said, quote, "Well, you know, I think David is mixing up my personal feelings with my position on the issue." He went on to say, "I always felt that same-sex couples should be able to enjoy the same rights legally as anybody else, and so it was frustrating to me not to, I think, be able to square that with what were a bunch of religious sensitivities out there. So my thinking at the time was that civil unions, which I always supported, was a sufficient way of squaring the circle. That, okay, we won't call it marriage, we'll call it civil unions. Same-sex couples will have the same rights as anybody else, but the word marriage, with its religious connotations historically, would be preserved for marriages between men and women," end quote. Well, what we really need to look at there, and the president went on to speak of the issue of same-sex marriage and his support for it in the interview, is the fact that when the president says Axelrod didn't get the story exactly right, the story he tells is quite basically what Axelrod said. Remember Axelrod's actual words. He wrote, quote, "Gay marriage was a particularly nagging issue. For as long as we had been working together, Obama had felt a tug between his personal views and the politics of gay marriage," end quote. Then in his response to Axelrod, President Obama said, "Well, you know, I think David is mixing up my personal feelings with my positions on the issue," end quote. So the president basically said what Axelrod said was exactly true. "My personal view is that same-sex couples should have the very same rights," the president was saying, "as opposite-sex couples, historically defined as marriage." But the nomenclature issue is where President Obama has hung his reputation, at least in terms of any consistent message on the issue. He says that he was always for civil unions, but that when he was running for president in 2008, he wasn't yet for same-sex marriage. But to BuzzFeed's credit, they went back to 1996, when as a candidate for the Illinois State Senate, Barack Obama did indicate his support for same-sex marriage. And in his response to BuzzFeed raising that issue, President Obama said this week, quote, "Well, yeah, the old questionnaire, you know, is an example of struggling with what was a real issue at the time, which is how do you make sure that people's rights are enjoyed and that these religious sensitivities were taken into account," end quote. That's an explanation that, quite frankly, I can't even decipher. But it does appear to be almost exactly what Axelrod wrote in his book when he said opposition to gay marriage was particularly strong in the black church, and as he ran for higher office, he grudgingly accepted the counsel of more pragmatic folks like me, again, this is Axelrod writing, and modified his position to support civil unions rather than marriage, which he would term a sacred union. Perhaps the most crucial section of Axelrod's book is where he says, quote, "Yet if Obama's views were evolving publicly, they were fully evolved behind closed doors," end quote. This tells us several things. It tells us, first of all, that when President Obama was running for the state Senate from a very liberal district in Hyde Park, that is centered in the area around the University of Chicago, when he was running for that office back in 1996, it was perfectly politically plausible to support same-sex marriage. When he ran for the United States Senate just shortly thereafter, not so much. When he ran for president in 2008, it probably would have been a political killer for him to have endorsed same-sex marriage. When he ran for president in 2012, well, as many journalists have noted, he did so with at least some sense that there was very little political risk to affirming in 2012 what he had denied in 2008, which he had affirmed in 1996. Secondly, from a moral perspective, a very important question was asked by Paul Waldman, writing in the Washington Post. His question, how bad was Obama's 2008 deception on same-sex marriage? He quotes the character George Costanza, famous of the Seinfeld program, who said, "It's not a lie if you believe it." And then Waldman asks, "But is it a lie if no one else believes it?" End quote. That's what he says is the real issue here. He says that no one covering President Obama in 2008 believed that he wasn't for same-sex marriage. And furthermore, there were a lot of winks offered in the campaign to that effect. But in terms of the moral revolution, what's really instructive about Waldman's article are these lines. Quote, "By 2008, everyone seemed to understand that the position all the major Democratic candidates were taking was a temporary way station on the path to an eventual embrace of full marriage equality. Nobody, says Waldman, really believed that that was where the party and its representatives were going to stay. Half of Democrats supported marriage equality in 2008, up from 40% in 2004, but the public as a whole was not there yet. Waldman continues to write, support for civil unions was a position that was acceptable both to the party base, who knew it was only a matter of time before their leaders evolved, which was undergoing, says Waldman, its own evolution. Waldman then asks, was all that a spectacle of political cowardice? Absolutely, he says. But it's hard to say that anyone in either party had many illusions about where it would end up, end quote. Now, on that account, Waldman is absolutely right. Going back to 2008, especially since we had in hand that 1996 questionnaire, nobody really believed that President Obama meant that he wasn't for same-sex marriage in terms of his personal belief. Then when he ran for president in 2012, a great deal had changed. And, of course, we're looking at the span of 4 years. That's the biggest issue here. To look at a moral revolution that isn't measured in centuries or decades, but in 4 years, the same 4 years between President Obama's election and his re-election. So one issue here is simply the ethics of truth-telling, and President Obama finds himself in an especially uneasy position on this because he affirmed in 1996 what he denied in 2008, later said he was evolving on, only to affirm again in 2012. But the big issue here is simply what it tells us about the evolution of the larger society, what Waldman writes about when he says the evolution of the politicians, it has to be tracked along with the evolution of the general population. This is a moral revolution, once again, that is happening faster than any other that can be documented in human history. The span of time between 2008 and 2012 was just 4 years, but in moral terms, those should be measured in light years. Well, tomorrow is Valentine's Day in America, but it also marks something else, and that is the release in cinemas of the film 50 Shades of Grey, the first in a series of films threatened, I won't say promised, in terms of the films based upon the stories in the 50 Shades series of best-selling books. Even though some cinemas may be showing the film early, it is scheduled to be released on Valentine's Day, and of course not by accident. But the reason I'm bringing up this development today is not so much to talk about the film, which doesn't deserve that much of our attention, but to the fact that there seems to be an ongoing conversation among many in America as to whether or not this is a film that should be seen, even by Christians, and whether or not it is actually pornography. And this leads us to have to think not only about modern cinema, but about the New Testament and its clear teachings on what is now called pornography. Given the nature and audience of this program, I'm not going to go into any detail at all about the 50 Shades series. It should suffice to say that it's not only explicitly sexual and pornographic in terms of its storyline, it also has become something even identified in the secular world as a gateway into what had almost universally been considered sexual perversions in years past. The movie narrowly escaped an NC-17 rating, and by some very skillful editing, it was brought down to an R rating. By the way, that's a commercial decision. If it had been rated NC-17, its box office income would have been cut significantly. But the reality is we're looking at a film here that is likely to attract millions of Americans as viewers. And of course, they know exactly what they're going to see. One of the things that's interesting in this is the fact that when we're looking at the 50 Shades series, we're looking at something that has exposed the fact that there is a real problem of female-oriented pornography. Even though male pornography is overwhelmingly visual, female pornography, as revealed in the massive sales of the 50 Shades series, is often narrative in form. In one form, it can be found in rather explicit romance novels. But as we've seen in the 50 Shades phenomenon, there is a real market for explicit narrative, that is, story-based pornography, which isn't so much driven by images, but by the storyline. And that has revealed the fact that a good number of women also struggle with the temptation of pornography. In many cases, if not most cases, the differences between men and women mean that the struggle with pornography, gender by gender, is actually different. But the sinful root of it is exactly the same. Just about everyone, including those who are secular observers looking at this phenomenon, understand that it is pornography. A.O. Scott, reviewing the movie for the New York Times, points out that it is pornography. He describes the movie as pornography, even if he says, and I quote, okay, it's a terrible movie, end quote. But he's not speaking there in moral terms. He's speaking in the terms of cinema criticism, of the evaluation of the film as a film, not as a moral statement. One of the other important issues to face in terms of this movie is the fact that what we're looking at here is, in its film product, a combination of pornography that is addressed to both men and women. For the overwhelmingly female audience of the 50 Shades books, there is a storyline. But for the males, who are expected also to see the movie, sometimes in the company of females, it is the images, for after all, film is a visual product, that will be driving the interest and, they hope, the box office sales. So from a biblical or theological perspective, what we're looking at here is the putting together of two very volatile and dangerous, downright sinful and evil impulses. We're looking at the basic impulse between male pornography, very visual, and female pornography, very narrative, put together in a film that is released, by no coincidence, on Valentine's Day. There should be no debate among Christians as to whether or not this is pornographic. And for us, it's not a legal description. You may recall the grave confusion that has been faced and, frankly, produced by many courts trying to define pornography. The late Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart famously said, "I can't define it, but I know it when I see it." That's not particularly helpful from a legal perspective. But that kind of logic is what opened the floodgates to an absolute deluge of pornography and other obscene materials over the last several decades. And, of course, you add to that the digital revolution, and we're looking at the fact that pornography is almost ubiquitous, found almost everywhere, just a click away. And what we're looking at is the reality that there is also ambient pornography, such that even modern-day advertising that you see in shopping malls and store windows, in magazines, and for that matter, even in billboards that can be seen along the highway, is involving images that would have been considered explicitly pornographic just a generation or two ago. But as I say, for Christians, there should be no question about seeing this movie or reading the books. There should be no question as to whether or not this is pornography. And for that, we need to turn to a biblical definition, not a legal definition. Because if the law is confused, the scripture is not. The Greek word from which we get the very term pornography is porneia. And what it means is an illegitimate sexual interest, an illegitimate incitement to lust, an illegitimate sexual message that could be, according to the scripture, because the scripture would include both, either something that is verbal or something that is visual. So far as the New Testament is concerned, it wouldn't matter. Porneia means it is a reference to sex that is outside God's purpose, it is outside God's plan, it violates God's law and robs God of his glory. That means any reference to sexuality that would lead in any way to a thought or an interest outside of marriage. Outside of marriage is the union of a man and a woman. Outside of marriage as that monogamous union, inside which and inside which alone the gift of sex is to be enjoyed. Now, what we're looking at in terms of pornography, well, we're looking at the fact that the courts have had grave difficulty coming to a conclusion and have basically demonstrated that they are either unwilling or incompetent to keep any flood of pornography outside of the culture. But what we're looking at in the church is often a confusion for which the church is far more culpable than any court. Because if the law may be confusing about how to define pornography, the Bible isn't. Put bluntly, if something creates in any of us a sexual thought that is not fully in keeping with God's plan for sexuality, then it is, by biblical definition, pornography. And thus it is, by biblical definition, sin. About that, there is no lack of clarity in Scripture. So while the cinema is trying to sell you 50 shades of gray and the courts are offering 50 shades of the truth, the Bible offers one very clear message about God's purpose for sex and sexuality and the Bible's definition of sin. And if you're not troubled enough, or at least as troubled as you ought to be by this, consider this release that came out yesterday from the Dallas Morning News. 50 Shades of Inappropriate is the headline, Middle School Kids Given Naughty Puzzles. It turns out that in one Pennsylvania 8th grade classroom, students were given a puzzle that had to do with the storyline explicitly of this movie. You can trust me that I can't read you much more of this story, even as it was found in mainstream media. But my point in raising it is this. Pornography set loose in the culture will not remain in the cinema. It will not remain to those who supposedly are limited to entry in the cinema by that R rating. It very quickly gets to the entire culture, and to make no mistake, it gets to the young. One parent cited in this article said, quote, "I asked my son who passed it out, and he said the teacher passed it out. I don't think," said this parent, "this is what they should be doing in the 8th grade level," end quote. The problem is, that's not what anyone should be doing at any age level. But make no mistake, it will make its way to the entire culture. And make no mistake, it will make its way to the young. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. Remember that tomorrow brings the first installment in the new season of Ask Anything Weekend Edition. You can find it at albertmuller.com, or if you're a subscriber, it should be in your feed. And in terms of Ask Anything Weekend Edition, remember that we want you to call with your question in your voice for future programs. Call us at 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. For more information, go to my website at albertmuller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.